Okay, so let's begin. I know it has been a very long week, so I will try to finish by 12 if you help me. What I'm going to talk about is this phenomenon, which were much less studied than LTP, that the synaptic strength is actually changing on a much faster time scale than what you heard about this morning. Namely, for even during the spike train with the typical frequencies of about 10-20 hertz, which are usually observed in the cortex, the effective strength of the synapse can actually change dramatically from one spike to another. So it's not clear actually whether the whole concept of this fixed synaptic strength can be properly defined. So I'll show you some results, experimental results, which were obtained in the lab of Henry Markram. And then I will show you some of the results of the computational modeling, which we are now currently doing, trying to get some ideas about what could be the implications of the short-term plasticity for the processing of information in the neocortex. Okay, but first experiments. I will just give you some of the pictures. This is to get you an idea how far the technology advanced, actually, how people can now record from pairs of neocortical neurons in the slice, so they can visualize them on the screen with the use of special infrared spectroscopy techniques. And then they can come with two electrodes and cell and make, Sebastian, I think, mentioned about it in the morning, they can do a whole cell patch recordings here, so they can come with the electrode, make a little hole here in the membrane of the neuron, and suck out this patch of the membrane here, and make a contact, electrical contact with the cell, and this way they can do intracellular recordings from the cells, which you can see on the screen, so you can identify the cells. Usually these are cells which are sitting right next to each other, so there is a pretty high probability that these cells can have a synaptic contact between them. And this way you have a much better chance to find the synapses, so as a result you can get bigger populations of synapses to study, rather than if you do it blindly, as people did previously, and then they had to go and record from many, many pairs until they could find a synaptically connected pair. This way you can be much more sure that you will succeed in finding the connection. And so if you do this, you can then stimulate, let's say, one cell by injecting the sharp pass of the current through one electrode and record and another one, and you can see the response. Okay. This is probably average of several repetitions of this, so you see this nice trace. So that's how the synapses can be studied now in the lab. This illustrates that you can, using this technique, you can actually identify different types of cells just by their shape, and this way you can start classifying the connections. You can ask all sorts of questions about what are the properties of connections between identified types of cells in the neocortex. Okay, this is the most typical example of the synaptic connection between two pyramidal cells in the somatosensory cortex of young rats. So you see, you stimulate the presynaptic cell with a train of action potentials. And I see there is no time scale here, but this is usually the frequencies which are reasonable, so let's say 10, 20 to up to 100 hertz. So you see a train of action potential. This is the response here. And you see, there is a very dramatic decrease in the amplitude of the response. You have a very strong response for the first spike, and it could be reduced by a fraction of this by the time this response is decayed. So this happened during the action potential. You see, the amplitude of this is enormous. For example, comparing to the what people observe in the LTP experiments, where if you are lucky, you can get increases of up to 50%. Here you get a decrease, you can really reduce the synaptic response to a fraction of its original level. So potentially this may have enormous consequences for the way the synapse, the neurons exchange information between them, because this spike is obviously creating much less impact on the postsynaptic cell than the first one. So there is a gradual decrease here of the impact of this message. If you think about this spike train as a message, it's not transmitted uniformly to the postsynaptic cell, but there's a gradual decrease of the impact. Now, if you wait for some time, the synapse gradually recovers, but it usually takes pretty long time for the synapse to recover to original strength. You have to wait for about a second or a few seconds until the response actually recovers to its original strength. So these effects are induced very quickly. You see, from the first to the second spike, there is already a very big decrease, but it takes a long time for them to go away. So the recovery of this is very slow, on the order of seconds. Okay, these were all average traces. So to get them, you have to repeat the recording several times. This gives you an idea about the fluctuations. So as Sebastian told you already, the synapses are stochastic. If you repeat the same, he spoke about the response to single spikes, that the response to single spikes is stochastic. It doesn't repeat itself if you do many times. Also, responses to the whole train is also stochastic. This gives you an idea about how strong the fluctuations are. After you average it, you get this nice traces, and you see the depression. But on each individual trace, there is a lot of variability, and sometimes you only see the response to the first spike. Sometimes you see a whole train, almost like an average, and so this gives an idea about the variability. Okay, so this raises the question of how, if you can really define the synaptic strength properly, because the synaptic strength depends on which spike you are looking at. So it could be, you could ask maybe that to define the synaptic strength, all you have to do is just to average over many spikes, to give a long train of action potential, then average, and this would be, for example, a definition of the synaptic strength. It turns out that this is also problematic, because this will depend on the average rate of this presynaptic, or average frequency of the presynaptic spike train. So if you give a spike train of increasing frequencies, the synaptic strength goes down and down. So this is, even if you wait until this transient is away and you get to some steady state, the steady state level of the response also is frequency dependent. You see, it decays with the frequency. So the higher is the frequency with which you try to stimulate the synapse, the weaker effectively it becomes. This is just an example of another kind of spike train. You know that neurons in the neocortex never fire this regular spike train, so they can be used in the experiment, but they don't reflect the normal operation of the cells. So usually cells fire something like a Poisson or just some random spike trains, and this tells you what will be the response of in the postsynaptic cell for this irregular spike train. You see this very high fluctuations in the response going up and down, depending mostly on the previous history. So if you have a spike which follows some interval of silence, there is a high postsynaptic response. But if you have several spikes within a burst of a high frequency burst, you have a very small, very weak response here. So you have constantly changing synaptic strength. It's never the same. Again, you can think about it that if you that the wiring of the neurons in the cortex changes from one millisecond to another. You never have the same configuration of synaptic connections, not the anatomically, but in terms of their strength, you never have the same network twice, right? Every time there is just one action potential, it changes a lot of synapses which originate from this neuron. So if you follow the evolution of the activity, you have a very, very fast changes in the synaptic strength across the whole networks. Okay. Now this is famous experiment by Henry Markov, which showed that actually this dynamic by itself is plastic. So if you have a, let's say you record from a pair of pyramidal cells and you test the synapse with this regular spike train, you get this depressing response. Okay, so you can characterize this synapse by, let's say, degree of this depression, how quickly the response is depressed. Now, if you try to do this LTP type experiments, which Sebastian described to you this morning, so you pair the activity, so you excite both of these neurons with high frequency bursts, and you arrange the spikes to be in a very precise timing relationship, so that the, let's say, presynaptic spike here is almost emitted a few milliseconds before the postsynaptic spike. We know that this leads to a long-term change in the synapse. Now, how would this synapse be, how can it be changed in the long term? You see that it's not characterized by just one synaptic strength, it's characterized by this dynamics of the depression. And so it could be, so a priori you could expect that it could be just overall strengthening of the synapse, so all of the responses could be strengthened, or it could be some change in the dynamics here. That's what in fact you observe in these synapses between pyramidal cells in the neocortex. If you pair them, if you pair the pre and postsynaptic neurons to try to induce the what you people usually call LTP, what you see if you compare now the response before and after pairing, you see that there was indeed strengthening of the response for the first spike, right? And that's a usual way of looking into it. If you look at this response to the single spikes, you have a strengthening of the EPSP. That's a typical picture here. After the pairing, after pre and postsynaptic neurons were fired together. But if you look at the response to the whole train, you see that there was a reorganization of the response. There was a like shifting of the frequency to the earlier spikes, but then the depression became more pronounced. So after you get to the steady state responses at the train, you don't see actually any difference. So the response for these spikes and for these spikes was not strengthening at all. So this means that what people commonly call LTP may be much more complicated phenomena. It can involve not just strengthening of the synapse, but the change in the dynamics of the transmission. So in this case, if it's a depressing synapse, depression becomes stronger. But if you measure the strength of the steady state response, you don't see actually overall strengthening of the. Yeah. All the experiments are by Henry Markram, who is my collaborator in the Weizmann Institute. Yeah, I will, when I'll talk about some computational models, I will exactly elaborate on this idea. Right, the most natural way to explain this is to say that you have some, if you have a limited pool of the synaptic vesicles, if you drive the synapse harder, you exhaust this faster. And so you should still explain why it exactly reaches the same steady state response. But if you write some simple models, you can see precisely why this mechanism leads to this effect. So first I want to give you some review of some recent experiments, and then I will talk more about computational models. This is all action potential. This is the response to the action potential. Yes. You have a presynaptic action potential. This is the postsynaptic response. Postsynaptic response are always subthreshold. They're weak. This is a this one. This is an experiment where you drive both of the cells by currents because you want to do pairing. So this is a test. It's exactly what Sebastian told you. First, test the synapses by just by stimulating one neuron and recording it in another. And this is never enough to drive the second cell because once these synapses are pretty weak. And then if you want to do pairing, you have to stimulate both of them in a controlled way so that they preserve this temporal relationship. But you have to inject current in both of them. And then you again go back to testing phase where you again stimulate a presynaptic cell and you record from the postsynaptic. So between here and here, you did this. So this should go between these two phases. So this graph summarizes this kind of plasticity experiment. If you show the change, if you only look at the steady state, and you ask what was the change in the synaptic efficacy at the steady state after this pairing experiment as a function of the frequency, you see that only at the very low frequencies you had an increase, but at higher frequencies, after about 10 hertz, the steady state didn't change or even went down a little bit, but this was not significant difference. So at high enough frequencies, the stationary value of synaptic strength doesn't change, actually. It's only the change in the dynamics. For low frequencies, you can say you cannot distinguish between these two. Okay, now this was all about synapses between pyramidal cells. As I said, you can now identify new different types of neurons, and you can ask questions about how synapses between different types of neurons differ between them in terms of their short-term plasticity. And this is an example of the synapse which originates from the same pyramidal cell, but one of it goes to another pyramidal cell, one of them goes to some interneuron here. So you record from three cells, you come with electrode to each of them, and then you study these two types of the connection, and you see that they may be dramatically different. Right? This is our familiar connection to pyramidal cell, which depresses quickly. But if you record from the interneuron to the same spike train, you see the synapse actually builds up. So it's not only that doesn't depress, it facilitates very quickly. And in this case, it can become so strong that it can actually drive the target neuron by itself. So it may be enough. The spike train of just one presynaptic cell can be enough to drive the postsynaptic cell to fire, because the synapse facilitates and becomes eventually very strong. Okay, so you have different types of dynamics here. Different synaptic types behave differently in terms of the short-term dynamics. So this is an example of this, another classical type of strongly facilitating synapse between pyramidal cell and interneuron. You see that it can facilitate by several fold factor here between the first spike in the train and when it gets to its maximum strength. I'll talk about it later, but actually if you measure the synaptic strength of the facilitating synapse as a function of its frequency, it's actually had this more non-trivial form. You remember for depressing synapses, it was steadily decreasing function with the frequency, but facilitating synapses have more complicated dependence on the frequency. So they become stronger initially when the frequency increases, but then if you really drive them hard, you start to uncover that there is also a depression mechanism which is hidden here at low frequencies. You start to uncover it, so at high frequencies, actually, they behave more like depressing synapses. I'll come back to it later. We have several types of facilitating synapses. they all differ. Basically, as I said, in every facilitating sense, you have some hidden depression, and by carefully studying them, you can recover the time constants which are associated with facilitating depression, and you have different combinations of these parameters. So you have different classes of facilitating synapses. This is a GABAergic synapse, so this is a synapse from interneuron into pyramidal cell, and you see it's characterized by facilitation, which is much slower than depression. So that's why you see facilitate, you have these combinations of effects. You have during the high frequency train, you have facilitation, which then leads to depression, but if you wait for some time, you see that depression is already recovered completely, but you get much stronger spike here because facilitation is much slower here. So facilitation can last for more than a second. And so sort of to the optimal response is actually evoked in the synapse if you have a give a high frequency burst and then wait for some time. So you here you induce both facilitation and depression, then depression goes away because it's fast, and you see a strongly facilitated response, which is much stronger than any of the response in this during this burst. So you have this very, you have a rich dynamics here of facilitation and depression, which can lead to this complicated responses. This is again this facilitating synapse, which has an optimal frequency at about 20 hertz here, where it has a maximal strength. You can have even this kind of synapses where during the burst you only see depression, mostly see depression, you don't see any facilitation. So it looks like depressing synapse during the high frequency burst. But if you wait and give this test spike, you see that there was in fact facilitation here. But you wouldn't see it here, presumably because the depression was dominating here. The probability of release was high enough so that this mechanism of exhaustion of the resources of this of the vesicles was so strong here that you wouldn't see that it overcame the facilitation. But if you waited again, you could see some substantial facilitation comparing to the first spike in the brain. So this is another type of facilitating synapse which you have. This to show that some GABAergic synapses are actually depressed, so there was no facilitation in this synapse. So there are different types and subtypes, so there is apparently very complex picture of different types and subtypes of neurons and synapses in the neocortex. And the main goal of the lab of Henry Markram now, this is his main sort of ambition, is to uncover this the whole classification of the neurons and synapses in the neocortex. Okay, I think I will not show you any more experiments. Okay, this was just intended to give you an idea that synapses are very complex. They have their dynamical elements, and there are many types of these dynamics. So it's very natural to start thinking about whether these dynamics can allow some computations to be done differently in the cortex, rather than computations which can be done with the synapses which have, don't have this dynamics. So you would like really to think about the computational significance of these effects. So the first step in this direction should be to try to capture this dynamics in a simple model so that you can then use them and simulate the networks. So Sebastian told you a lot about biophysical mechanism of synaptic transmission, but what I now, my goal now for the next like 10-15 minutes will be to tell you that actually you can have a very simple schemes which capture most of these effects of synaptic depression and facilitation, which you can then use in the network models to study the effects of this. So that's a general scheme of how we model these synapses. So you have to put both effects of facilitation and depression, and the idea here is very simple. You say that you have this kinetic scheme is responsible for synaptic depression. So you have some pool of the synaptic resources. For example, you saw this pool of the vesicles which were stored on the presynaptic side. And so the idea here is that after the presynaptic action potential arrives and it releases the vesicle, the site remains empty. So if the next action potential comes immediately after the first one, this site cannot be utilized anymore because there is no vesicle which is ready there to be released. Okay, and so this site gets very quickly into an active state, right? It produces the response, right? So this vesicle is released, it binds into postsynaptic receptor, produces the postsynaptic response, but then this site gets inactive and it takes time to reactivate it. And so this time is long, it's on the order of seconds. So this mechanism is the simplest idea which could explain the synaptic depression, just depletion of the neurotransmitter. Right? For some reason, the neurotransmitter cannot be quickly recovered, so if there are many spikes coming, they exhaust all of the synaptic resources, and there is nothing left for the next spike. So the synapse have to wait until the synaptic resources recovered and can be utilized by the next spikes. Now, facilitation here is explained by another mechanism, which is the increase in the probability of release. So when the action potential arrives, it doesn't, even if the vesicle is available at the presynaptic site, it's not released with 100% probability. There is some probability of release, which can be anything from few percent to 100%. And so this parameter can by itself can be dynamic. It can be that from one spike to another there is an increase in the probability of release. And there is another time constant associated with this. So this time constant is associated with the recovery from depression, and this time constant is associated with the recovery from facilitation. So every time there is an action potential, this what we call utilization parameter, or just probability of release, is increased by some factor. And then without the spikes, it reduces back to the baseline. Yeah.
Would this be the case when this release probability is very small compared to
the action of... That's true. If the release probability is close to 100%, then you won't see any facilitation because it's already 100%. So it's indeed true that facilitation is seen in the synapses where initial probability of release is pretty small. And you can actually check this, that facilitating synapses have initially a small probability of release, and then it builds up. And depressing synapses are usually the synapses which have high probability of release to begin with. So even if there is facilitating mechanism, you won't see it, and the main effect will be the depression. So you see, you have a bunch of kinetic parameters here which describe the dynamics completely. It's mainly these two time constants, tau recovery and tau facilitation, the recovery sort of and facilitation. And you have this another parameter which tells you about something like initial probability of release, basically. So three kinetic parameters is enough to describe dynamics. And it turns out that by just playing with these parameters, you can describe most of this variability which you see, from going all the way from strongly depressing to strongly facilitating to these different types of facilitating synapses. Just by playing with the combination of these three kinetic parameters can explain you most of this variability which you see in the neocortex. Okay. So let's see what can you do actually with this sense. I will give you two kinds of computational models which you have. So first is first kind of models are just intended to convince yourself that the model actually this phenomenological model of the synaptic dynamics captures the main effect. So you try to come up with some predictions which you can go and directly test with the recordings, and then I will tell you a little bit about the network modeling which we did recently, trying to understand some computational implications of this. So as I said, there are few kinetic parameters here, and you can compute with them, you can compute the response to any spike train. So let's see how this corresponds to the experimental facts which I showed you. Let's first take the purely depressing synapse, so no facilitation. And you can do all types of computation there. So for example, you can compute the steady state response of a regular for a regular spike train. So you give a regular spike train of a particular frequency, and you can compute what will be the steady state efficacy of the response, amplitude of the response, and you come up with this formula. It depends on these kinetic parameters, depend on the interspike interval, and this is tau recovery, this is the U parameter, this is just a scale, overall scale, which you can call the synaptic strength. So there are already a couple of interesting observations which can be done here. So if you go to high frequency, let's take delta T much less than tau recovery. So then you can expand this exponent, and what you get at the end is that for frequencies which are high, actually they have to be more than 1 over tau rect and U, you get this formula for the steady state response. Okay, so you see that it doesn't depend on U. First observation, doesn't depend on U. So one of these parameters falls out. It doesn't matter what the initial probability of release is. It falls out of the expression. And another observation is that it's inversely proportional to the frequency. So if you drive for high enough frequencies, if you drive the synapse with high and high frequency, the synapse becomes weaker proportionally, inversely proportional to the frequency you try to drive it. Now this can be. This is some quantitative prediction which can be tested easily. So all you have to do is again to repeat this experiment where you drive the synapse with periodic spike train of different frequencies and you plot the response amplitude as a function of the frequency, and you indeed see that after some frequency it falls onto this 1 over F curve. Say it again? Okay. So you can convert this scheme into a simple equation. You say, so remember you had the synapse here, then the action potential arrives, and let's say you had some amount of the neurotransmitter here, let's say denoted by R, the amount of the resources which you have. So the spike arrives and it utilizes a fraction of them. Okay, and then it becomes ineffective, and you have to wait tau recovery until this synaptic resources recover, right? So the amount which you utilize by the spike is given by U times R. Okay, so it means that the amplitude of the response which you will observe, which you will record, is always given by the response. Let's say postsynaptic potential is always given by U times R. Okay, now this R changes from spike to spike. If you come with the next spike, you will have less R available. So what the equation for R will be? It will be very easy. So R dot, the change in the R, will consist of two terms. First one is the recovery. If there are no spikes, it should recover back to 1 with the time constant of tau rec. So it will be 1 minus r over tau recovery. Okay, so this guarantees that if there are no spikes, eventually everything will recover to its original strength. Okay, so this is, it will recover back to 1. Now, the moment the spike arrives, it takes out some fraction of what's available at the given time. Right, so it takes this fraction u of whatever is available, but this happens only at the time when the spike arrives. Okay, so that's an equation. So this is in a case where there is no facilitation in the sentence, so this parameter u is constant. If there is facilitation, you have to add another equation which describes the evolution of this parameter from one spike to spike. And that's the simplest case. Okay, so now if you have a, so this can help you to compute the response for any spike train. So now let's look what happens if you have a spike train which is of equally spaced spikes with the time between them delta t, which is just 1 over f. So now you can convert this differential equation into the, iterative equation for the r at each consecutive spike, right? You can figure out that can I do it? So let's see. Let's say for a spike number n, you had a value of Rn, right? When the spike arrives now, it immediately takes away fraction u of it. So immediately after the spike, this will go down to Rn times 1 minus u. And then it starts recovering to 1 if there are no more spikes. So after this, after the time t of the previous spike, you will have r of t equals Rn times 1 minus u times e to minus t over t recovery plus 1 minus e to minus t over t recovery. Okay, so this is the solution of this equation without this term, with the initial condition of Rn times 1 minus u, right? Without the spikes, this term is 0. You have just linear differential equation, so it approaches 1 with this time constant, and this is the effect of the initial condition. Okay, so this means that if now the next spike comes at an interval delta t, the amount of the resources which is available by the next time will be Rn plus 1. So instead of t, you just have to put delta t. So it will be Rn times 1 minus u e to minus delta t over t recovery plus 1 minus e to minus delta t over t recovery. Okay, so that's an iterative equation for the subsequent responses. And now if you have this periodic spike train where all delta t's are the same, it eventually reaches the steady state. And at the steady state, these two will be the same, right? Right? So this gives an equation for the steady state. Right. At the steady state, Rn and Rn plus 1 are the same. So what you get then is that R equals 1 minus e to minus delta t over t recovery times 1 minus u e to minus delta t over t recovery. Okay, so that's a steady state response. If you multiply it by u, this will be a response. This is just the amount of the resources. as a function of the frequency and these two kinetic parameters. Okay, now you say, now to get this limit, you take the case where delta t is much bigger than, much smaller, sorry. The frequency is high, so it's much smaller than 1 over t recovery. Okay? So you put it in here, you expand the exponent, what you have then is r. This will be 1 minus this, so 1 minus mine minus this equal, then it will be delta t, t recovery. And here it will be 1 minus 1 minus u, 1 minus delta t, t recovery. So if you simplify it, u okay, now we are talking about the case where this is very small, so actually you can neglect this term. So what you get is 1 over f g recovery times u. Okay, so this is the steady state of r. Now, if you want to compute the response, you have to multiply it by u, right? Because this is how this is the amount of the resources which you will have at every spike. So to compute the response, you have to multiply it by u, because every spike utilizes the fraction of u of this. So the value of the steady state of the response will be proportional to 1 over f times t recovery. Okay, so that's why you see that the dependency on u disappears here. So it means that the higher u you have, it means that the higher fraction of the resources you utilize for the first spike, but then exactly it cancels out, so that the amount of the resources which is left will be proportional to 1 over u, right, at the steady state. So at the steady state you won't feel any of the effect of the initial strengthening of the response during the spike train. Okay, so that's kind of calculations you can do, and it's very easy then to go and test this in the experiment. Okay, now the consequence of this behavior with the frequency is actually pretty important, because if you have this dependency with the frequency, that the synaptic strength decays inversely proportional to the frequency, it means that if you now look at the overall average current which is created on the postsynaptic cell as a function of frequency, then you'll have to multiply it by the frequency, right? Because if the frequency becomes higher, the number of spikes which is transmitted grows linearly with the frequency, but the effect of each spike now behaves inversely proportional to the frequency. So this means that the overall effect of the presynaptic firing will saturate at higher frequency. So that's what you see here. If you plot as a function of frequency the overall response in the postsynaptic cell, now here it's average membrane potential, this should be a linear function of the presynaptic frequency if every spike would be transmitted independently. But because of the depression, you see that it grows only for low frequencies, but then it saturates. And then at higher frequencies, the average average response doesn't depend on the presynaptic frequency. So you can think about it that the average frequency is not transmitted by the synapse, right? At the steady state, the response is insensitive to the frequency. This is again the experiment which directly tests it, not for periodic spike trends, but for irregular spike trends. You stimulate the presynaptic cell with the Poisson spike trends of increasing frequency. This is the responses which you observe. And now if you just compute the average of the postsynaptic voltage as a function of frequency, you see that it grows for, initially it grows, and then it saturates. So for frequencies which are above 20 hertz in this particular case, there is no further increase in the voltage as a function of the frequency. And that's of kind of the curves which you can compute with the model. So you see the shape of the curve should depend strongly on this parameter. For strongly depressing synapses, this saturation occurs at low frequencies. If you have a weakly depressing synapse, the saturation may not occur until very high frequencies. So, for example, this would be one way of getting an idea what should be the typical value of this parameter for depressing synapse. So it should be around something like 0.5. That's what indeed you can measure. Okay, so on the average you see that there is no sensitivity to the frequency. However, if you change the frequency quickly, there is a transient response, and this happens because if you have a imagine that you have many presynaptic neurons converging to the same postsynaptic cell, and they all increase their frequency at the same time. So immediately after you switch up the frequency, you have more spikes arriving in the postsynaptic cell. But for most of these first spikes, the synapse is not yet depressed, right? So it still has the original strength corresponding to the lower frequency. But until it depresses further, you have more spikes already, but you have yet the stronger synapse. So for a very short time, you have an increase in the response. And that's what you get first in simulation. So this is, if you simulate the population of presynaptic cells which converge into the postsynaptic cell, that's what you see. So if you have just one cell, you see you have a response which will have the same average. But if you now add more and more presynaptic cells, so go from one to a few hundreds, you start seeing these transient responses. So by the time you get to 500 neurons, you see very clear response. So if you go from 1 hertz, a sharp transition to 10 hertz and to 40 hertz, you see very clearly that, for example, if you go from 10 hertz to 40 hertz, you get this transient response, and then the postsynaptic current or voltage goes back to its original value. So there's no difference in the average between 10 hertz and 40 hertz. But if there was a synchronous transition from 10 to 40 hertz, you have this transient response. So the synapse transmits information about the change in the frequency, but then it loses information about the value of the frequency. So if the frequency is sustained, the information about the actual value of this frequency is lost. You cannot distinguish between 10 and 40 hertz.
I lost why does this depend on how many neurons feed into?
Well, that's how you see it, because if, let's say, you have one, then you don't see really a transient signal because you have a lot of transients for any spikes. But if you have many spikes, you have many neurons, so the postsynaptic current becomes smooth, and this then you cannot cover this.
If you averaged over a population,
it's not average; it's a summation.
I understand, but if it's just this fluctuation, and if you average over a population,
right? That's what we did in the experiment. So in the experiment, if you just do one spike trend, you will see something like this. But what you could do to test this, you could do couple of hundreds of the traces like this, and then you just average, and then you did see, that's what you see in the experiment. You create a couple of hundred of these Poisson spike trains. For each of them, you make a recording, so you will see something like this. But then if you average out this individual transients, and you see this very nice transient for transition from 10 to 40 hertz, and it goes exactly to the same level. So you confirm this property again. Okay, you can again do some analytical calculations with these populations, so pretty much the same way. So let me show you here. So let's assume you have a Poisson. Let me also draw something simultaneously. So if you want to gain some more insight about this issue of what is precisely the information which is transmitted by depressing synapses, so you should consider a population of presynaptic cells, each firing some Poisson spike train, right? And in general, the rate of this Poisson could be any function of time. So let's say this population fires with the frequency, the population rate, or the rate of this Poisson process is some function of time. And now all of this spike train converge into a postsynaptic cell through the depressing synapses. And you want to compute. So if you compute now the response, so the postsynaptic current which is generated here, as a response to this firing, you can maybe get an idea about what features of this are transmitted. What is about the presynaptic firing which is transmitted to the postsynaptic cell, and what information is being lost? Right, so we already know that if this firing frequency is constant, then the value of this constant is lost. Right, but the moment there are transitions, there are some transient responses which, so the information about the changes is transmitted. So if you want to analyze it in a more general situation, you can make these calculations. So you can write this equation for each of the synapses separately, right? And this will be a spike train going through one particular synapse. This is the equation for one individual synapse. And then you want to average, or actually the same thing as to sum up all of the effects of the presynaptic firings. So this can be done if these are Poisson spike trains, and if they're independent. So if these Poisson spike trains are independent, so only correlated through the common firing rate, f of t, then you can make the average, and the average will be just replacing the delta functions here by the f of t, because this f of t gives you exactly the chance that there is a spike at time t. So there are some little subtleties here which I can, somebody will be interested, we can go through these calculations and discuss all the subtleties here. But on this simple round, you just replace this delta function by the f, and you can show that this product can be factorized. So if you average, you can average separately this factor and this one. So we have here the average of R and F. So for the average response, or for the average, right, you will get this equation here, which now depends only on the doesn't depend on the individual spikes, but only depend on the rate of the presynaptic population. Right? And again, to obtain the current, you have to multiply this by the frequency and by the U. The frequency gives you how many spikes there are. This is the average fraction of the neurotransmitter which is still available, and U gives you how much of this is utilized. Right, so all you have to do, you have to solve this equation for a given firing rate, and then to compute this product. And this gives you, in general, the response of the postsynaptic cell to any pattern of firing of the presynaptic populations. Right, so you can solve it in general, but it's more instructive actually to look at this this way. So this is a non-linear equation, you see, because all this model is non-linear because there is a product of R and delta here. But you can write it in this quasi-linearized form. You can write it still as a relaxation to a steady state, to instantaneous steady state. So for a given value of f at the given time, you can define the steady state, right? This is the steady state for a given f. So if the f would be constant, this is what would all these r's would converge, right? And this would have this shape. Now, even in this case, you can write this equation as a relaxation to this steady state, but the time constant of this relaxation itself depends on that on time, right? It's not constant in time, it depends on the current value of the frequency. So you can view this as a relaxation at any moment, the R tends to relax to its steady state, quasi-steady state, with a time constant which itself changes all the time. Right, so if you figure out these equations, that's what you'll get, that the time, effective time constant depends on the frequency itself. It's given by the recovery time constant of the depression times the value of the steady state. So it's given by this equation. So for high frequencies, it becomes 1 over f. So it means that effectively, this equation becomes faster for higher frequencies. So the rate of the change is adjusted to the frequency. So this gives you the characteristic time scale, right, with which the synapse follows the changes in the frequency, right? For example, if you go from one rate to another, there will be some transient, and then it will catch up with the new steady state. And the time with which it will catch out will be given by this tau. So you see, it's frequency dependent, so the higher frequency you go to, the faster it will follow the changes in the rate. And it's interesting that if you it's adjusted such in such a way that the number of spikes which are emitted is always on the order of 1 over u, right? So it's always on the order of 1 spike. So you can get some intuition here that the synapses are work in such a way that no matter what change in the frequency you do, right? Let's say you go from one frequency to another, the response which will be generated, as I told you already, it will be a transient and then recovery to a baseline. And the width of this on this transient is adjusted so that there will be on the order of 1 spike emitted here. So the synapse transmit information by very short packages of the order of 1 spikes, right? And then it doesn't follow anymore. So that, then it loses information about the rate. So if the rate changes all the time, something like this, there will be all these transients, and they will last for about the time for the synapse to emit about just 1 or 2 or 3 spikes here. So that's kind of intuition which you get here, that it really doesn't transmit information about the rate. It transmits information about the changes in the rate, and it transmits them pretty fast, so that it only takes time for just few spikes of the presynaptic cell to be emitted, so that all of the information is transmitted. And then if there is no further change, the synapse somehow switches off and it doesn't transmit any more information. Okay, so it gives some intuition that it should be very effective for transmitting activities which changes quickly, but it's very ineffective if the presynaptic activity is constant in time. Right. After a few spikes, there will be no more information transmitted. Okay, that's some intuition. Now I have a choice. I could either... Huh?
Yeah, so just to get some intuition about the reverse process, what happens when you lower the frequency? Do you see anything else?
Well, you'll get the same thing. Don't show the figure, but if you have a... If the frequency is decreased, what you'll get is you'll get some transient decrease and then it will go down. But it will not be symmetric, right? Because the duration will be high. So if you compare, let's say, these two things, there will be a faster transient here than the dip here, because the dip will be determined by the new value of the frequency. If you go to lower frequencies, the dip will be longer here than the peak here. It's not linear, yeah. Because the relaxation time constant itself depends on the activity. Okay, now I have a choice. I could either tell you something about facilitating synapses or about the network with depressing synapses. And I think I will go for the network. So you can do some similar analysis for facilitating synapses, but I won't tell you about this now. Yes, already somebody asked me that we should all prepare the list of references for the talks. So next week I will distribute the. Okay, can you take out this cover from the. Okay, so I'll show you some of the results of our ongoing project of trying to understand what would be the properties of the recurrent network with the synaptic depression. And Alex is here, so if you have some questions, you can ask either me or him about. I will just go briefly now because I really want to have you enjoy the Santa Barbara a little bit. So the motivation for this, actually there are several motivations which you could put forward here. One of them will be that, okay, you have these properties of the synapses, it's very strong. The strength can go up and down by a factor of 10 during the same spike trend, so it's natural to try to ask the questions of what novel kind of dynamics on the network level could emerge. But in retrospect, you can come up with other motivation. This has more to do with the issue of the neural code. So this was discussed in length by Larry in his lecture, where he described to you how he believes, or many people believe, that the computations are carried by the rates and not by single spikes. Right. And how you understand this, what's the rate, and so forth. Now, there are cases, some observations, which are actually very hard to reconcile with this, so at least not very obvious how to do this. And in particular, these are the cases where the neurons respond to stimuli with just single spikes. Right. No matter what the stimulus is, it could be even tonic excitation, but the neuron somehow resists to get activated constantly. They just fire one spike in the response to the stimulus. This is the example I give you is from the work of Alan Elkin on the auditory cortex, where there is a lot of information on this slide, but I only want you to concentrate on this raster plot. So this is the response of a neuron to some natural sound. More precisely, he recorded from the auditory cortex of the cat, and the cat was listening to a bird song. And this is a response to the fragments of these bird songs. And you see that you have some neurons which, and this is the repeated response, so you repeat the same stimulus several times. And you see these responses which are basically just one spike. Right, so it means that if you look at the response on the one trial basis, you wouldn't even notice this, because the neurons sometimes fire spontaneously without any stimulus. So the only way you can actually detect that there was a response here is by repeating it and and noticing it, and noticing that this spike always occurred at the same latency after the stimulus onset, right? Otherwise you wouldn't know that this neuron responded at all. So, okay, of course you can still describe it as a firing rate, because the way Larry defined it, you would just have to sum up the spike counts in a very small bit, and you would see that the spike count shoots up here. Right? So the firing rate of this neuron, if you define it the way Larry defined it, is indeed going up very sharply here, and it remains zero anyway. But if you think about the rest of the brain which should interpret this, it cannot average it here, right? It has to deal with the single trial responses, and then you have to ask yourself, how does the brain can distinguish this spike, which is a phase lock to the stimulus, from all other spontaneous spikes, because the brain doesn't know when the onset of the stimulus was. And the possible idea would be that, in fact, you have many neurons which respond in the same way. So that if you could record from many other neurons, maybe you could find that the different neurons would fire these single action potentials at the same time. And then the rest of the brain could just look at this population activity, and it will easily see that there was a response in it, because during the spontaneous activity, there would be no coincident firing. Okay, so this is not a new idea. People were sort of playing with this kind of ideas of coincidence firing being the actual message of the computation, of the information transfer. Here it looks like this would be the only reasonable idea, right? Because you don't have here increase in the overall firing rate defined as just a spike count. You don't have many spikes here evoked. It doesn't seem to be any other simple idea of how the information about the sound could be transmitted by these neurons. Of course, this still requires experimental confirmation by doing multi-unit recordings here. So it turns out that so if this is the way the information is being coded and then sent to other areas, you have to find a way of this coincidence firing to be generated in the networks, right? You have a networks of neurons responding to this auditory signal, and you have to find a way of selectively generating these coincidences in the response to the stimulus. But you don't want that these coincidences will be generated just spontaneously, or you don't want them to be generated in response to any stimulus, because again, this would be bad for information transmission. So the problem which you have here is trying to devise a mechanism of generating coincidence firing of neurons in the networks, presumably with just single spikes or with few spikes, in a way which is selective to stimulation, right? And it should be robust against spontaneous noise and so on and so forth. So it turns out that the recurrent networks with synaptic depression have this property. And let me first show you how can you see it in simulation. So if you just set up the randomly connected network of integrated and fire neurons, and you simulate them according to this integrated and fire equations. So integrated and fire equations, so integrated and fire equations made a stability equation for the stability equation of all the negative, if you ignore all the effects of everything on that, so everything about the channel, the channel, and you replace all the variations that left in the spiral generation that is the traditional set potential, there is a set differential five as a vector of the zero and five as a set potential. So this can give you way of simulating simulating the neurons which are going to simulate actually this complex simulating all this complex conductor dynamics. Which you could have tried to do it with the Hodgkin Haras, with the Hodgkin Haras, with the Hodgkin Haras, well, we just took the same. The same about 1 second. The same about 1 second. The same model. We should use the same model. which proved useful
where basically no synchrony happens and no coincidence happens, to the regime where from time to time you have a coincidence firing. And this is completely spontaneous, so I say, we don't put any inputs to evoke this. Just from time to time the network synchronizes and then desynchronizes again for a period of about 1 second. Okay, so again, if you look at the single spike train here, you wouldn't see any difference here because there is no increase in the number of spikes emitted here. It's just that for this short period of time, the neurons adjust their timing of their spikes so that they occur almost at the same time. So in order to see it, you need to observe the whole network here. But if you observe the whole network, this is a very dramatic effect. So the population rate shoots up very dramatically, right? Because you have many, many spikes which occur within the very short time beams here. And then this again, the synchrony disappears until it happens next time. Completely spontaneous bursts of synchronization here. Huh? Well, if you simulate it, it's not completely periodic, but it's... No, it's almost periodic. You have some variability in the inter-spike intervals, but it's much more regular than possible. And presumably, if you make a network bigger and bigger, it will become more and more periodic. Okay, now you can do some tests and then check that this indeed happens because of synaptic depression. This is just an illustration. There's not a proof that this happens because of synaptic depression, but if you plot the average strength of the connections here, you see that it goes sharply down here during this spike and then recovers slowly. So this is like a threshold effect. Whenever the recovery occurred up to some level, there is a next burst. So it makes you think that there is some instability here in the network which develops slowly. Then it comes into fruition here and then there is a burst. So without the synaptic depression, the network would be always unstable here. So it would fire with a very, very high rate. But synaptic depression prevents this instability from sort of occurring all the time, so that's why it occurs only at the discrete times with the time interval about 1 second between them. Okay, now this is this issue of the selectivity. We wanted that, so the spontaneous bursts are not very interesting because they don't carry any information. But it turns out that if you now go back to the regime where there are no spontaneous synchrony, the ability of the network to synchronize is still around. So if it's sufficiently close to the transition, you can evoke the things by even weak stimulation. Right? So this shows this. If you have a network which by itself doesn't emit any bursts, so there is no synchrony in the network, but you can, by selectively targeting different neurons, you can evoke this. So let's evoke this. So let's show the results of the simulation where you target different populations of neurons with this very sharp impulses, excitatory impulses. And then if you take, let's say, 30 neurons and you target them with the impulses of the same amplitude, then sometimes you can see that in response you get this synchronization in the network, right? But if you take the same impulses and send them to other neurons, you won't see it. So you have stimulus-evoked synchronization, and which is selective to precise nature of the stimulus. So if you go, and exactly what happens is that if you go and target the low-rate neurons, you get this response. If you go to high-rate neurons, you don't get them. And the reason is that the high-rate neurons have their synapses depressed more, and so if they fire, their impact on the network is less. So they are not able to cause this rapid synchronization. Low-rate neurons, they have stronger synapses, so they can recruit the whole network and cause it to burst. Now, Alex is now working on the rate model of this network. I just show you a few of the results. So you do the same network. You want to get more analytical understanding of what kind of stimuli the network responds to, how it responds to different types of stimuli. So I just don't want to bother you now with the equation. So you write down the same kind of equations which I wrote for single synapses and for Poisson rates. And just let me show you a few of the results of this analysis. So this shows that you have indeed this sharp transition. So if you gradually, Okay, so this is some of the examples of what this network do in response to different inputs. So this is a example where you take the network which by itself doesn't produce synchronization, and then you at some point you suddenly increase the input to all of the neurons. So you can think about it as a tonic stimulus. Like if you record from the auditory signal, you just can give a tone. You pronounce some pure tone, which is at the good frequency for a neuron, and then the neuron responds to this. To this tone, and you see, if you look at the network, what happens here is that there is just one burst which is emitted at the onset, and then it settles into a new stable firing with slightly increased rate. So most of the response here happens just at the onset. So again, if you look at the neuron, you would see that it only fires one spike in a very precise temporal relation with the onset of the stimulus, but then there is maybe slight increase in the spontaneous activity, but there is no further response. So there is a transient response, and this is a very well-known fact about the way auditory neurons respond to pure tones, that they always respond in a very transient fashion. They respond just with one spike at the onset of the tone, and then there is no observable response, even if the tone is continuing for a long time. So you see the network does similar thing. It produces this one synchrony event and then no further response. Now if you want to evoke this this synchronization bursts more, you have to provide some temporally changing stimulus. So, for example, you can give a periodic set of pulses, and this will be a better stimulus for the nerve. So, if you give a periodic set of pulses, if the frequency of these pulses is not too high, you can evoke the response to each of the pulse. Right? So you get, this is the synchronized burst for each of the pulse. But again, if you increase the frequency of them, the network cannot follow them anymore. So it starts missing them because synaptic depression prevents it from generating these responses too often. Right. Remember that these responses are mainly generated as an instability within the network. It's not a response, direct response to the stimulus. So if the stimulus comes with a high frequency, just not strong enough by itself, so the network just misses some of them, and it doesn't want to respond with a frequency which is higher than about 1 hertz. And so if you increase it even more, you can get to the situation where it stops responding at all. So it just responds at the beginning. But if you get to very high frequency, you drive the network with very high frequency, but in turn, it just stops responding at all. And this also was measured in the auditory cortex. If you drive the cell with the too high frequency, temporal frequency, they just stop responding at all. Not only they miss some of the pulses, but they just don't respond at all. And finally, I want to show you some interesting examples of interference. Now, this you already get a feeling here that the network is highly nonlinear. So it means that by knowing the response to simple stimuli, it's not so easy to predict what will be the response to a combination. Right? Let's say you have two stimuli acting together. You cannot just record the response to each of them and then to superimpose it. And this is a very striking example of this, which also was motivated by the recordings in the auditory cortex. If you first give a periodic pulse, set of pulses here, the network responds to them. Now, if you now superimpose it with the tonic excitation, you know that for the tonic excitation, it only responds once at the onset. Now, you could expect, if it were just a sort of a linear combination, you would expect that here it would emit an extra burst at the onset, and then it would continue to respond to this train. But in fact, you see there is no response anymore. So this tonic excitatory input managed to suppress completely the response to the train of pulses here. So there is a very strong effects of interference between the stimuli if they appear at the temporal proximity. So presumably this raises up an interesting possibility that in fact the network can realize very complex computation on the temporal signals. It can actually respond in the way which is very sensitive to precise temporal organization of the stimulation. For example, if you have a complex sounds where different frequencies, cadences, come and go at a particular times, this raises up the possibility that you can realize interesting computations based on this kind of temporal inputs due to this strongly nonlinear effects of interference. But this is still, we are now getting into the phase sort of pure speculation because this was not yet demonstrated. Okay, thank you. I think I stop here. If you have questions, I can take some. Yeah, that's actually that's a case of low frequency. This is about the frequency which is determined by this time constant. So if it's about 1 second, so it's 1 hertz. So if you go up to 1 hertz, the network can follow every pulse, and then it starts missing the pulses. Okay, seems like there are no more questions.